Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of the Digital Zoo podcast. This episode is special because I'm actually producing it for a class that I'm in called Anthropology of Latin America. I'm calling this episode Seeds of Activism because I'm actually re-exploring the baby corn episode that I did for this in a more academic-minded mindset than usual. So I hope you like it, and here's to a new episode. For this particular show, I'm going to explore how gender activism and environmental activism often intersect in Latin American activist spaces. I really wanted to revisit Mother Seeds in Resistance, which I did already cover for this podcast, but I really wanted to look at again because I actually covered it before the COVID-19 pandemic, which, as we all know, had quite a large effect on our supply chain. When I revisited the webpage, really ended up catching my eye was that Mother Seeds acknowledges that most indigenous farmers are in fact women, and the group was really created in order to support that specific community. What Mother Seeds in Resistance really is about is the current fight to protect heritage maize and other heritage grains in Mexico. What began as a seed bank collaborative among farmers now combats big business introducing GMO seeds, and it's really evolved. It's actually been an organization for around 20 years. And some of the first donations were from Zapatista farmers in Mexico to farmers all over the planet. In fact, as you're going through the Mother Seeds in Resistance website, you see a lot of African nations are going out of their way to support the seed bank. And there's a couple pictures of Kenyan activists proudly displaying their seeds on the official website. The movement also states that they are currently growing Zapatista corn in 6 continents. Now, the movement seeks to support indigenous and Zapatista communities in Mexico who are currently fighting climate change and the still raging COVID-19 pandemic. In 2021, the resistance partnered with DESME, or the Social Economic Developments of Indigenous Mexicans, in order to expand and serve even more people in Mexico and beyond. The seed bank is now so much more, and small farmers can request food crops, perennial herbs, and grafted trees. The farmers who use this bank then share the results of their labor with the surrounding community and creating a really great small supply chain. The website's newest update really covered how COVID-19 has disrupted small farmers in rural communities. It really caught my attention, and I did some research using a DW article by Charlie Shield titled "Who Controls the World's Food Supply?" and a 2020 article by Rita Jill Clark Golub, Erica Takeo, and Avery Raimondo, titled "A Nation That Cannot Feed Itself Is Not Free," which I found on the Via Campesina website. We're going to start with the article titled "A Nation That Cannot Feed Itself Is Not Free." This article discusses the long-term devastating effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on the world's food sources. The World Food Program says that there is a, quote, "real danger that more people could die potentially from the economic impact of COVID-19 than the virus itself," end quote. And there was also a predicted increase in food insecurity for Latin American communities especially. This insecurity has been tied to the rise of dependence in Latin American countries on foreign food companies to bolster their economy. These companies value profit above all else and force small farmers to sell their product at poverty prices. La Via Campesina believes that what they term as agribusiness is one of the leading causes of food insecurity among Latin American countries and other countries that are also in the Global South, which we will discuss the Global South in just a minute. These companies use CAFOs, or confined animal feeding operations, that crowd animals so that viruses are spread more easily, and then they're able to pass to humans. These companies are the third largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, and genetically modified seeds are known to diminish biodiversity. La Via Campesina advocates for the food sovereignty movement, which in their words is the right of people to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods. and their right to define their own food and agriculture systems, end quote. So in other words, small farmers should have the power to practice traditional and sustainable farming practices while being able to govern access to their ancestral lands that are free from pollution. I really enjoyed this article because it really highlights why peasant movements are so effective because, and I have this other quote from the article, small farmers and peasants produce 70 to 75% of the world's food on less than one quarter of the world's farmland, end quote. So these protests and activist movements related to food production are so effective because the supply chain would be massively disrupted if these grassroots organizations decided to stop producing. And these grassroots organizations are supporting people who are massively already disrupted. I got curious about what the Via Campesina article was talking about with agribusiness. So through that, I found Charlie Shields' article about who controls the world's food supply. So Charlie Shields' article covers the same sort of issue, but through a more economic and legal lens. Shield discusses the monopoly GMO companies have on seeds themselves and the laws that can keep indigenous farmers from keeping heritage plants alive. Why do these companies have such a hold over the market? In the DW article, I learned that in the 1990s, laws protecting GMO crops were introduced. And these GMO seeds that were now protected was because of just four companies, Bayer, Corteva, ChemChina, and Lamigram. They now own over 50% of the world's seed supply. So how and why do these companies exercise this monopoly? Farmers who need to buy their seeds sign seed contracts with these companies saying that they cannot save any seeds for the following planting season. These companies then get patents on the GMO seeds so they can limit how many seeds can be sold and potentially create a false scarcity just so they can keep their monopoly on the market. Farmers can only grow one crop instead of the traditional practice of a variety as a safeguard in case of crop failure. This can also lead to a degradation of the soil and also leads to crop failure. Why is this a threat? Like we have said, GMO plants are not as diverse as heritage grains, and that can lead to more famines and shortages in the long run. And we do see in the article and a few other pieces of media we'll discuss later that indigenous farming practices are known to be incredibly stable and sustainable because they were used for many, many years before colonization and were able to support a very large number of people. Now, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that 75% of the world's seed variety has completely died off since these seed laws were introduced in 1990. What are the seed laws, essentially? The World Trade Organization does not allow membership to a country unless it has some form of legislation that, quote unquote, protects plant variety. And one way that countries can do this legislation is by joining UPOV, the International Union for the Protection of New Varieties of Plants. What UPOV actually protects is these new GMO plants. This organization limits the production, sale, and exchange of seeds. So this is sort of a growth with the seed laws that we just talked about. By imposing this temporary monopoly on a certain type of GMO seeds, big businesses like Bayer, Corteva, ChemChina, and Lamigram, as well as UPOV, can claim that they are fostering innovation. A big requirement to join UPOV is that, quote, commercial seeds must be genetically distinct, uniform, and stable, unquote, which is not a quality that you find in heritage grains that aren't bioengineered. So Shield then claims that UPOV is a tool of neocolonialism, as members of the European Union, the United States, Japan, and Canada, who are part of UPOV, pressure countries in the global south to join and introduce industrial-style farming techniques instead of indigenous practices. So the global south is basically south of the equator, and these countries are largely victims of colonization. Part of what the assignment for this class was is to discuss a current event like this seed activism movement and connect it back to some material that we've covered in class. One of the first ones I want to talk about is this documentary called Berta Didn't Die, She Multiplied. During the course of the class, we just explored the concept of gender and post-colonial effects on the Latin American political landscape. One of the pieces of media we discussed in class sort of discusses the intersection of these issues, which is Berta didn't die, she multiplied. It was directed by Sam Vinal and covered the aftermath of the death of Honduran political and environmental activist Berta Cáceres. So Berta fought for environmental and gender justice in her community, and she was murdered in her own home for it. She firmly believed that we can't have one victory without the other. She supported gender justice, LGBTQ justice, and indigenous rights, along with environmental activism. She really recognized the intersectionality that often gets overlooked in activist spaces. And the title of the documentary was actually a chant of the protesters after Berta Cáceres' mysterious death inside her home. Berta was an indigenous land defender in Honduras, and as the opening of the film shows, she's really widely recognized for her work as a defender of indigenous land sovereignty against extractivist companies and state policies with awards and media coverage. The rest of the film sort of explores the ripple effect her death had on the land sovereignty movement that she was a part of. There were a lot of interviews with people that worked with her in her protests, who talked about how Berta stressed the importance of intersectionality in activism. She was a feminist, pro-LGBTQ, and pro-Indigenous person, and she wanted the people she worked with to do the same. She really recognized the intersections of race, gender, and class in society, and how these separations really weakened movements. And I have here a really great quote from Sam Vinal, the director, and he was talking about the documentary in the synopsis of the film on IMDb. Quote, "The insidious agents of the local oligarchy, the World Bank, and North American corporations continue to kill, but that will not stop the social movements. From Flint to Standing Rock to Honduras, the water is sacred and the power is in the people." And this documentary was really powerful, and I believe that Vinal really illustrated this idea through the film. Berta's death was really supposed to shut down the movement, but it kept going, and in fact it was the catalyst for more protests, and the members were left more passionate about their cause. The state ideology that Honduras' government has a very colonial mindset, thinking that by criminalizing or disappearing leaders, they can completely destabilize a movement. But it was shown that that is not the case. What we do see in the choices made in the documentary is what the story is and how they tell it. They start with news coverage about all the great things Berta has done, and then we make a hard cut to the coverage of her death. And we see very clearly that there was more coverage just about her death than about all the work she did when she was alive, and how difficult it is to get your message out there. As the documentary progresses, we see all these wonderful interviews with people that worked with Berta, and they explain what they loved about working with her and what they're doing to keep her memory alive in the movement. And Berta's message about the importance of intersectionality in activist spaces can be seen in the academic article Coloniality of Gender by Maria Lugones. It really explores how collective action can fail if the male members still hold patriarchal views and center themselves. It's a really interesting paper that explores the intersectional lens needed in activist spaces. So the title, Coloniality of Gender, what does coloniality mean? It's sort of the mindset left behind in the spaces of victims of colonization. As the act of colonizing a people involves more than just control over the political and economic spaces of a group. It means creating a new culture that people are forced into. In this paper, Lugones explores how gender and race perceptions are altered from their original context during the act of colonization. Gender expression isn't a fixed concept, and that's sort of a common perception now of gender, that it's a fluid concept that is reaffirmed by cultural and political vectors, and these vectors were used during colonization. When one nation colonizes another, their social and political values are imposed in order to establish a hierarchy of colonizer and colonized. This hierarchy is also reflected in the home, and that's the point of colonization, is to basically enter the minds of the people and change their values. There are very strict gender roles for women in the home as part of a colonized identity, and this strict idea of what a man is supposed to do and what a woman is supposed to do in the home is a part of the ideas imposed during colonization. Lugones argues that until an activist space confronts their ideas surrounding gender and gender roles, collective action will not truly reflect the collective population of community. Many men in Latin American spaces believe wholly in their dominance over women and want to maintain this. They're not willing to let go of this in an activist space, especially over women of color. And I found this really powerful quote from Lugones in this paper. She says, quote, "Women of color feminists have made clear what is revealed in terms of violent domination and exploitation once the epistemological perspective focuses on the intersection of those categories. But that has not seemed sufficient to arouse in the men who have themselves been targets of violent domination and exploitation any recognition of their complicity or collaboration with the violent domination of women in color. In particular, theorizing global domination continues to proceed as if no betrayals or collaborations of this sort need to be acknowledged or resisted." So this is sort of a theoretical framework for how the documentary Berta Didn't Die, She Multiplied discussed how we can decolonize activism in activist spaces. We need to acknowledge how race, class, and gender really do alter under a colonial power. And finally, I'd really like to discuss how the documentary and the academic paper truly intersect. And in order to do this, I actually found another article by Alma Martinez, and it was translated into English by Elise de Vega, called No Environmental Justice Without Gender Justice. And I found this in Pie de Página. So this article covered a conference about the two different struggles in Latin America of gender justice and environmental justice and how they work together. It uses the ideas put forth by Berta Didn't Die and Coloniality of Gender. This conference was in October of 2021, and the Simone de Beauvoir Leadership Institute was the organization that created the conference, and it was titled Women Land Defenders, Action and Resistance. This conference was meant to examine how patriarchal views in Latin America can lead to policies that don't really reflect a population's values. We hear from a lot of different activists, but first we hear from Milivan Aspuac. She is a member of the Women's Association for the Development of Sactapecuez in Guatemala. And quote, she explained that changing how they think is the first act of resistance in the defense of their territory, because practices can't change without mindsets changing first. This article, as well as Aspuec herself, calls for people to question the ways in which they live. How does the current system uphold colonial ideals such as capitalism, racism, sexism, and power relations in the home and interpersonally? There definitely is a prejudice against women of color in many Latin American communities, as we saw in Coloniality of Power. There's this perception that women of color are uneducated and can't handle anything other than housework. Aspuac continued, stating that in order for indigenous communities to truly achieve land sovereignty, they had to center traditional practices such as growing their own food, creating food sovereignty, making their own clothes, practicing their own culture and ancestral practices, such as traditional medicine and traditional farming practices. This conference continued and talked again about COVID-19 and how it served to set back the feminist movement even more, as women's work in the home drastically increased during this pandemic. There's a really severe lack of state support during the pandemic in most Latin American countries. So women and the grassroots organizations they created had to take over their children's education and care while dealing with record job losses. In this absence of government support, these women's organizations that met for the conference were the main source of support for rural communities during the pandemic, which, as we discussed really early on in the episode, most of these small farmers are indigenous women. And even though they are mostly indigenous women, it's usually in a front yard garden. And less than 30% of these indigenous women that grow food on their land actually own the land they grow on. And this act of growing and selling food in your front porch contributes to land sovereignty and food sovereignty. These same organizations and their members have actually been targeted by the state as victims of armed violence, as we saw in Berta's documentary. They often protest and advocate for land sovereignty, which is directly against the politics of the state in Latin America. The state and these outside colonial companies do not make deals with these largely indigenous and female communities. They make deals with government officials who don't have the best interests of the community at heart and often are violently extractivist. But just like Berta, these women activists in Latin America are major invisible contributors to the economy, and they pose a real threat to the state and extractivist companies. The fight for gender justice and indigenous sovereignty intersect because both activist struggles obstruct the system imposed on Latin American societies, such as neoliberal policies and companies infiltrating and corporatizing indigenous farms. Centering indigenous voices in talks of land sovereignty is only the first step in decolonizing land use in Latin America. These grassroots movements have been shown to be successful when they acknowledge the intersections of race, gender, and class in Latin American society. We see that often people who fight for justice are criminalized and dealt with accordingly by the state, as we see in the documentary. This makes the community built by these grassroots movements all the more important, because we see that they cannot die with just one. As I was writing the script for this episode and starting to record, I found that I really wanted to focus on the scars of colonization and how that still impacts life in Latin America. There's pressure from colonizer nations to join their special organizations, and Latin American communities are relegated to the title of Global South as a way to cover up the scars of colonization. Sort of says the quiet part out loud of saying they're from the South, so technically they're under us, and it imposes sort of like a hierarchy of cardinal directions, because there's the global North and the global South. These countries that are members of the global South, like Latin American and African countries, are still dealing with the devastating effects of being colonized. But the so-called global North does not acknowledge this. They just expect the countries and communities they decimated and continue to exploit to be able to pick up the pieces and fully integrate themselves into the global economy started and operated on the global North's terms. Even in grassroots activist spaces where the community is vital, racism and sexism are still pervasive, as we saw in Coloniality of Gender. Indigenous sovereignty and gender justice can't be achieved until members of these collectives confront their biases created by colonial powers. They must look up from the distorted mirror of colonialism, which is a concept introduced in class by Anibal Quijano in his paper Coloniality of Power, Eurocentrism, and Latin America, where he discusses how a lot of Latin American countries are altering the way their governments work and the way their economies work so that they can enter global capitalist spaces at the expense of their own people. And these communities have to look up from the distorted mirror to truly see the potential of intersectional movements and truly honoring indigenous and minority voices. As I was rewatching Berta Didn't Die, She Multiplied and rereading Coloniality of Gender, I was really struck by the idea that kindness and understanding in a movement is in itself the true revolutionary act, as coloniality can't be dismantled with the tools and mindsets of the colonizer. By decentering the idea of global North, global South, these activist spaces can start to make real lasting change in their communities. As we're bringing this episode to a close, I really ask you, my listeners, to please check out Mother Seeds and Resistance's page yourself. This is a really amazing organization that wants to support all these great communities who are suffering from land sovereignty issues. There's a little button on their website where you can donate, or you could just share the page on your social media. It's always great to support organizations like these that are grassroots and really looking to help real people. Please don't hesitate to check out my other episodes. They're not as academically minded as this one, but they are in the same vein of food anthropology and how culture changes over time. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.